This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, my name is Gary Clinton, and I'm here to entertain you with some old radio shows. Well, at least I hope you entertain me with some old radio shows. That's what we do around here, play old radio shows. The first show tonight is one of Arch Obler's plays from Lights Out. The show ran on September the 28th of 1943, and is called The Author and the Thing. I'm going to step out of the way now, and here it comes.
This is Arch Obler bringing you another in our series of Stories of the Unusual. And once again, we caution you, these Lights Out stories are definitely not for the timid soul. So we tell you calmly and very sincerely, if you frighten easily, turn off your radio now.
Miss Goddard, answer the phone, please.
Yes, Mr. Obler. Yes? Oh, yes, Miss Harrison. Here he is. Mr. Obler?
Yes?
Miss Harrison.
Oh. Oh, thank you. Hello, Joan. How's the Phantom Lady? Yeah, am I in trouble? Well, the last light's out. I just don't know what to write about. Oh, no, I got plenty of ideas, but... well, men dying in foxholes, and what am I doing? Thinking of fantastic... Well, thanks very much, but I still insist that I ought to be... Yeah, okay. Sure, I'll make this last one a good one, and then that'll be that. If I live through it. No, I was just talking to myself. I've been doing that rather consistently these last few days. Yes, I guess all those zombies and ghouls and Luke Garous have finally caught up with me. Yeah, I know. Two aspirins and a glass of water every half hour. Now, look here, Miss Harrison, don't worry about me. I'll get the story written tonight if I have to talk to the devil himself to do it. All right, John, all right. Yeah, sure. Oh, fine. Call me back in an hour and I'll have some kind of a plot figured out, I hope. Give my regards to Norman. Talk to you later. Well, Miss Goddard, let's get to work.
Yes, sir.
What time is it anyway?
11:32.
Sorry I have to keep you working so late.
That's perfectly all right. I know you have to have that play done by tomorrow morning. I'm glad to help.
You're an angel. Angel? That's a strange word to use here in this room where I've thought up so many demons and monsters. Tell me, or maybe you won't want to tell me.
What, Miss Elva?
Working with me on these lights-out plays, do you ever get frightened?
Well...
You do, don't you?
Yes, I do get frightened many times.
There was a time I'd have found that very amusing, but not tonight.
Is there something wrong, Miss Obler?
I don't know. Tell me, did you ever sit alone in a room at night and have a premonition? I mean, suddenly get the feeling that somewhere in the house, perhaps in the darkness in the next room, something was waiting, something of malignancy and evil... what's the matter with me? If I keep on talking like this, they'll be using me as Exhibit X in a psychopathic ward. Come on, let's get to work.
Yes, sir.
Let me see. We'll start out next week's play with the regular lights out opening. Lights out, everybody. Chimes, later than you think. Gong. First character is named Hellman. Call him Hellman. Jack Hellman, H-E-L-M-N. Who else? Got it?
Mm-hmm.
He commits a murder and he, Oh, what's the use? I can't write another one of these things. Ghosts and groans and blood. I tell you, I can't do it.
Mr. Obler.
I'm sorry. Look here, Miss Goddard, you better run along.
But aren't we going
no,
to...
No, I just can't write anymore tonight.
But the cast, they'll be standing by. The rehearsal.
Devil with the rehearsal. I'm not going to go insane writing these things for anybody. Now, run along, please. Try to get some rest and you come back early in the morning. We'll see what we can do.
Just as you say. Are you sure you're all right?
Please go.
All right. Good night.
Good night. What's come over me anyway? Why did I tell her to go? I gotta write this play. Premonition. She must have thought I was getting soft. Who's there? Oh. Well, I am in bad shape. The wind rattles the window and I... Lights out, author goes nuts. They're the headline for Variety. I gotta get down to Earth. 11:45. Joan said she'd call back in an hour. I've gotta have some kind of a plot by then. Let me see. How about a press agent named Black killing a man named White and Black and White murder? Ooh, that corny. Maybe I could use a story about a Hollywood producer. Let's see, Johnny Auer. He meets a girl and then's afraid because the girl's husband. Oh, is that out of character? How about Nero chopping off heads in the Roman circus and... Certainly it's quiet in here. Yell all day for quiet. Now that I've got it, I have got the jitters. What the devil have I got to be jittery about? Things are what they are. If anybody knows that, I do. 2 and 10 makes 4, unless you're talking about curved space, and them that has hold on to what they've got, and anybody who's in this war for profit ought to have his bones broken off. What the devil am I talking about? Okay. I'd better stop kidding myself. I know what's wrong. I want to write it, and yet I don't. What's the matter with me? Afraid to put it down on paper? What have I got to be afraid of? Here it goes. Get it over with. And outline of title undecided. Get out of my system. Play opens in the cell of a monastery in the Middle Ages. A mystic is cowered in a corner of his room. Outside, a mob is clamoring for his life. It appears that a horrible crime has been committed in the village below. A horrible monster had torn a woman. It appears that this creature, brought into being through the incantations of the sorcerer, was the concentration of all the evil in men's hearts and minds. A tremendous force of fiendishness and inhumanity put into living flesh to roam the world and commit unspeakable... Of all the drivel. A tremendous force of fiendishness and inhumanity put into living flesh to roam the world and commit unspeakable... Well, drivel enough. There it is on paper. Me own monster conceived in me own mind. Congratulations, Papa. Have a cigar. Conceived in my own mind. That's what that crazy monk said in that book Nat Wolf gave me. I wonder who gave Nat that book. Conceived in... Where's that book anyway? It ought to be... Yeah, I even marked the page. And I say unto thee that if thou shalt be evil and do evil and think evil, and let thy mind rest upon this evilness in the light of day and in the darkness of night for 7 days and 7 nights, there may come into being a thing of evil, and it shall take the form of the evilness of thy thought. Written by half-starved mystic more than 10 centuries ago, and I... Funny I should have thought of those words tonight. I've been thinking about them for a week. Shall take the evil, the form of the evilness of thy thought. 7 days and seven... Oh. Who's there?
No! What the? You in my mind. You're just in my mind. No. You evil. You don't exist, I tell you. I thought, Chap, you're a dream. I said a dream. When I wake up... No, it is a dream. It's got to be a dream. Come in. Get me out of this dream. Come
in. Hi, Art. Well, don't you ever open doors anymore? So what's the big idea sitting in here all
night? It's not a dream. It's still...
Hey, Art, what's cooking?
Eli, get out.
Oh, now, Art,
don't stand there looking at me. Get out. Can't you see it? Get out of here.
Hey, what's the gag? See in here what?
Behind you. Look behind you.
Well, there's nothing behind me but the wall.
Eli.
Say, what is this, anyway? A preview of...
Eli, get out of here.
All right. Now, let's have it. What is this, a preview of a new play? Boy, am I glad you're quitting lights out after all.
Can't you hear him?
Hear who?
Eli, behind you.
Behind me what? What's the matter with you anyway, Art? Don't you feel well? You keep staring back at me.
It must be a dream.
What's that dream?
It must be a dream.
What's the matter? The pink elephant's beginning to get... No!
My brother! No, my brother, let go of me! You think to my brother! No! Eli.
Oh, no. Eli. Operator, please. Send police right away, my brother. Please, send police. My brother.
How much time we got to go on this ship yet, you? Oh, hold it. Here comes Frank Sinatra again.
Squad 39 and 48. Go to Ventura and Radwood. Drunk making a disturbance. Claims his brother ate by a monster. Squad 39
well,
and 48.
You.
Go to Ventura and Radwood. Drunk claims brother ate off by a snake. LPD signing off.
I tell you, it's true, officer, it's true. I brought my own brother. I saw it. I saw it with my own
eyes. All right. So
you
don't. Now take it easy, young fellow. You're in a bad shape.
I tell you, I'm not drunk. I'm as sober as you are.
Now, don't get funny.
You thick-headed fool. Look, it's there behind you.
What?
The thing, the monster. Look at it. Please, my brother.
Oh, I've heard of him seeing snakes and pink elephants, but this is the first one I've seen this bad off, eh, Joe?
But your door looks tight.
Oh, you never can tell in the valley.
There, those are the two of you. Can't you see him? Can't you see him? Lovin' there in the corner.
Hey, maybe we better take him down to the station and let him cool off in the can for a while, eh?
Yeah. Stop staring at me, the two of you. Why won't you believe me? Why won't you
believe me? Hey, Clarence, maybe this guy's on the level.
Oh, are you nuts, too? If something happened to his brother, there'd be someone around, wouldn't there? And there ain't nothing in this room.
What have I done? What have I done?
You've done? What do you mean?
I thought of the monster. 7 days and 7 nights.
See, Joe, the guy's nuts.
Let's find out who he is. What's your name, young fella?
What's your name? Quiet down now. What's your name?
Oh, what difference does that make? I'm thinking, sits there and grins at me. Why don't you see it? Tell me, what
is
it?
Oh, come on now. What's your name? Let's have it.
Opler. Oh, Eli.
What's your business? What do you do for a living?
Eli.
Well?
Radio. I write radio. What's the difference?
Radio? Opler. Say, ain't you the guy that writes them screwy lights out things Tuesday night?
Yes, help me. Please help me.
That Joe?
Why, this is the guy that writes them ghost things I was telling you about. You know, over the radio. Obler. The guy who always makes his cops Irish. You get it? It's one of them gags. One of them publicity gags.
Gags? Oh, you infernal...
No, wait a minute, fellow. Watch your tongue.
I tell you, it's not a gag. It's here in the room. It took my brother and... Can't you hear it?
Huh?
It's laughing. An infernal laugh. Listen to it.
It is later than you think. Okay, young son. If it ain't a gag, you better take a broom and go back to bed. Now, listen, you. We're going to hang around for a while, so take it easy. Come on, Joe. Let's get out of here.
No, wait.
Who is that?
Wait. Don't let me down. It's here, I tell you. It's here. Don't let me. What'll I do? I got to get out of here. I've got to get out there and find someone who'll believe. What? Oh, it won't let me out? No. Don't come near me. Please, come back. Come in.
Hi, Art. Oh. I was just riding by and I thought...
No, Mercedes, get out of here, get out.
What?
Art,
what's the matter? What are you staring at?
Mercedes, believe me, you got to get out.
No!
Mercedes!
No!
Help!
No!
Oh, no!
Help! No!
Oh, no!
Hey, what's going on here? Didn't we tell you to go to bed? Is that the way to act? We heard you screaming all the way down in the...
Oh, no. Where did she come from?
She, her corner.
Give me a gun. Huh? That thing in the corner there, won't you look at it? Won't you believe me? Give me that gun.
Get away from me.
The gun, I'll shoot it.
No, stand where you are. Let you have a slug. Huh? You got it coming to you, that girl. They'll burn you for it as sure as my name's Clarence McMenzer. And I'd like to be the guy that pulls the switch.
All right, right in here, sir. You got 5 minutes.
Yes, I know.
Oh, Miss Gang. I've been waiting for you.
I got here as soon as I could. Looks bad, Obler. Very bad.
What do you mean? I didn't do anything. I tell you, I didn't.
Oh, yes. I know. But, Obler, you can't do a thing like that and just walk away from it.
Well, I'll explain it to you. I'll explain it to everyone 100 times, 1,000 times. Won't anyone believe me?
Now, look here, Arch. I'm your attorney. I want to help you. A great number of people want to help you, and we certainly can't do a thing unless you cooperate. Yes, that's what I said. Cooperate.
What do you want me to do?
Tell the truth. The whole truth.
But I told you.
Yes, yes, I know what you told me. A horrible thing that you conceived in your mind came to life and did a number of peculiar things. See here, surely you don't think that even the most stupid jury on earth is going to believe that nonsense?
You don't believe me.
Well, I've heard many peculiar alibis from my radio clients in time, but... Well, listen, if you want to plead temporary...
But I'm not insane. I'm not insane. I'm not insane.
Then let's hear a sane explanation of what happened that night.
I told you. I told you everything just the way it happened. My brother came home and...
Yes, yes, I know.
Well?
Your brother came into the room and was eaten up by this monster and then that girl. Oh, what's the use? Apparently you want to die.
I've tried so hard to make you understand.
I've tried to make you understand that if you don't stop this infernal nonsense and hurry up and tell me the truth of what really happened... You'll either find yourself taking a one-way walk to the electric chair or wake up in a padded cell in an asylum for the criminally insane. The fact of the matter is, they've already appointed a lunacy commission to pass on your case.
Lunacy?
Oh, see here, Arch.
Wait. No, wait. Let me talk.
Go right ahead. That's what I want you to do.
Maybe I am insane. I don't know. First, I told myself it was nothing but a nightmare. That I'd wake up and find it had all been nothing but a weird dream that never really happened. But it's not a dream, and no one will believe my story, not even you.
It's such an irrational story. How can you expect anyone to believe it? Now, take that part about your brother being devoured alive by this monster.
It happened. It happened just as I said it happened.
It's common knowledge that your brother is pre-induction vacationing up north with your mother.
He came back.
You mean they are coming back. I sent your brother a wire to come back and bring your mother home at once. They ought to be here today.
My brother dead.
Well, that's your preposterous story. This thing, this monster who's supposed to have committed all these crimes. Where is he? Where did he come from? Where has he gone to?
I don't know.
Did the police see him? No. Did anyone see him? No. Oh, Arch, if you're going to think up an alibi to save yourself, for heaven's sake, think up a better one than that one.
I'm not trying to think up alibis. I'm just trying to explain what happened. To you and maybe to myself. I haven't believed much during my life, except perhaps that somewhere there was a power that went beyond life and death. What happened to me isn't explainable in any terms that you and I... But, Mr. Gang, I tell you, it did happen. I thought of a monster for 7 days and 7 nights in my own mind, and like that prophet of the Middle Ages warned, the evil thing came to life, and yet only I could see it and hear it.
And do you see and hear it now?
No. That's what I can't quite understand. Perhaps the horrible thing only has life when I think about it intensely.
That's it. It only has life when my thoughts give it life. Like an idea. Don't you see, Mr. Gang? Like an idea only exists when you think of it. Your thought gives it life. And that's the way it is with that terrible thing. Listen. Listen. Do you hear him? There he is in the corner.
What?
I tell you, he's there. Don't you hear it? Slobbering and slobbering. I see it now. I see it. You think... I'm not afraid of you anymore, you hear me? I'm not afraid. I'll kill you. I'll kill you.
God!
I know how strongly you gentlemen feel about this matter, but after all, we must come to a decision on his mental status. As chairman of this lunacy commission, I feel that it is incumbent upon me to, shall I say, summarize the facts as they have been placed before us. First, it is an established fact that a murder, and a very horrible murder, has been committed. The police officer has testified very conclusively that Arch Obler was there upon the scene of the crime, and that it was absolutely impossible for anyone else to have committed the murder. In other words, the man whose mental status we are to determine is a murderer. Consider further facts. Does he wear conventional shirts?
No.
Another fact. Does he participate in normal activities such as drinking, dancing, fraternal orders, and similar beneficial social activities?
No.
I pile fact upon fact.
Have you gentlemen ever listened to his play?
Apart
are some of the distinctive features of these works? Voice.
Strange
voices. Whispering voices. No, that gentleman always whispering voices. Voice. Gentlemen, I am of the firm opinion that we are dealing with a very definite case of Dementia Praecox in its paranoidal form.
But no,
No.
My time in an insane asylum. Oh, my. I'm not a sailor.
No, of course you're not, son. But don't excite yourself anymore. Please. Let me make you go.
If there was only some way I could make them see the thing as I see it. Mother, you believe what I told you, don't you?
Yes, dear, of course I do. Eli would only get back.
Eli? But I told you, Eli would... You're like the others. You don't believe me. Now I know you don't. Will believe. I'll make you believe. Sing wherever you are. Listen to me. I think of you. Here, I think of you. I give you life. You hear, Mother? You hear it does exist? It does?
No, don't get so excited.
There, Mother. It's right behind you. Turn, see, believe.
Oh,
you see, Mother. You see, I'm not insane. I'm not insane. No. My mother. Saying my mother. No.
All right. Hello. Oh, yes, John.
Midnight already?
Yeah, I've been sitting here very comfortably, and I finally thought of the plot line, and believe me, it's quite a brainstorm. I die.
Sure, it's my final broadcast, so why not?
No, I'm not gagging. Listen to me. You know, it's all about a monster that I conceived in my own itty-bitty mind, and it comes to life. Honestly, I haven't had a Coke in hours. It's going to be one of those, you know, crazy stories inside of a story. Now, listen. The way I've got it figured out is this. Now, I'm supposed to be sitting here thinking of this horrible monster, and suddenly I turn around and there it is, eh? And my young brother comes in, and this monster eats him up alive, and then Mercy McCambridge comes in and... Wait a minute, Joan. Hold it for a minute. I think someone came in. I imagine it's Bernie. I'll see who...
No! Joan, listen! That thing, it's true. This time it's really happening. No!
Second show is a shorty from The Strange Dr. Weird. The Strange Dr. Weird was a show which only ran 15 minutes and lasted from October the 7th, 1944 to May the 15th, 1945. Altogether, they did 28 episodes. Tonight's show is called A Stand-In for Death and was the eighth of these 28 shows and aired on December 26, 1944.
The Strange Dr. Weird.
Good evening. Come in, won't you? Well, what's the matter? Surely you're not nervous. Perhaps a story might calm your nerves a little. A story about an undertaker and death. I call it Stand In for Death. My story begins in the small, dimly lit undertaking parlor of Charles Thompson. Thompson and his son, Paul, are listening to the news broadcast.
As yet, there has been no further news about Tony Williams, the notorious gangster who less than an hour ago shot and killed Detective Walter O'Hara and fatally injured a 6-year-old child in making his getaway in a stolen car. The entire police force is on the search for Williams. It is believed that...
To think that Tony Williams is our cousin, a man like that...
Oh, Dad, you mustn't take it so hard. After all, it... No, I'll answer it. Tony.
Dad.
Want the whole neighborhood to know I'm here. Lock the door and pull on the shades. Yeah. Hurry up.
Why have you come here, Tony? What do you want?
I need a hideout, and this is going to be it.
No, Tony. I won't let you hide out here. You're nothing but a mad killer.
Yeah?
Tony, put away that gun.
This gun's the reason you're going to hide me out here. You understand?
Yeah.
You understand?
We understand.
And just do as I say, and you may live. I'll have to lay low here for a couple of days until the heat's off. I've had a chance to make some plans.
Well, come, Paul. It's 4 o'clock. We must leave.
Wait a minute. Where are you going?
We're taking old Luigi Gambone to Woodcrest Cemetery to bury him.
Woodcrest? It's about 5 miles out of town, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Are there going to be any mourners at old Luigi's funeral?
No. Luigi had no relatives.
The city was going to bury him in a pauper's grave until we claimed his body.
Ah, this gets better and better.
Why are you so interested in old Luigi's funeral?
Because old Luigi's funeral is going to be my funeral.
What? What are you talking about?
This. I'm substituting myself in a coffin for Luigi. All you two have to do is drive to the cemetery. There, I'll get out of the coffin and head for my hideout. After I'm gone, you bury the empty coffin and nobody will be the wiser.
But Luigi's body. What do we do with that?
That's your problem.
No, I won't do it.
You'll do as I say. It'll be 3 corpses in this room instead of one. Now dump Luigi out of that coffin and make it fast.
We're starting, Tony.
Okay. Remember, if the cops stop you, don't let them get suspicious or else.
No, Tony, we won't.
Paul, there's a man signaling us to stop.
No trick. If you try anything, I'll come out of this coffin shooting, and the first 2 bullets will be for you.
Be quiet, Tony. Here he comes. It's O'Hara, the private detective.
O'Hara? The cop's brother.
Yes, now be quiet. Oh, hello, O'Hara.
Hello, Charlie. I thought it was you. Lucky I caught you. I was just going to drop in on you.
Drop in? On me?
That's right. Where are you headed for?
We're going out to bury old Luigi at Woodcrest Cemetery.
Old Luigi, huh?
Yes.
I suppose you heard the latest about Tony Williams?
Yes, I heard it over the radio. I'm sorry about your brother, O'Hara. He was a good man.
Yeah. You haven't by chance seen Williams lately, have you?
You know I've never had anything to do with Williams. Never.
Sure, Charlie. It's just that I thought you being Williams' cousin, he might just possibly have come to you for help.
Oh, no. We haven't seen him in almost a year, have we, Paul?
No. No, we haven't.
That's all right, Charlie. Say, do you mind if I ride along with you?
Huh?
There's a few questions I'd like to ask you about Williams and his habits.
But I just got through telling you I haven't seen Williams in almost a year.
What are you getting so excited about, Charlie? All I want to ask you is a few things about Williams. Get this. I'm going to see that Williams gets what's coming to him. And I'm going to be awful suspicious of anybody who doesn't cooperate with me.
Well, you mustn't mind my father. He always gets excited when someone mentions Williams' name. You know we're more than glad to answer any questions, Mr. O'Hara.
Yes, of course, O'Hara. What do you want to know?
You can get started, Charlie. I'll ride part of the way to the cemetery with you. You can answer my questions on the way.
But we can talk here. We wouldn't want to take you out of your way.
Oh, no, that's all right. Me private dicks always have plenty of time. I think there's enough room for me to sit up front with you. Just slide over a bit, will you, Charlie? That's it. This is fine. All right, Paul. Let's be on our way to the cemetery.
Dr. Weird's merry tale will be continued in a minute. Which reminds me, Doctor, did you have a Merry Christmas yesterday?
Young man, don't mention Christmas to me.
Why, what's the matter, Doctor?
I was hoping to get a skeleton this year, but...
Dr. Weird, I know just how disappointed you are. And gentlemen, if you were hoping for an Adam hat this Christmas, but didn't get one, I can sympathize with you, too. The new line of Adams this year certainly are tops in design and quality workmanship. So don't be disappointed. Get an Adam yourself. Walk into any of the thousands of Adam hat stores or authorized dealers from coast to coast and try on a fine-looking Adam. There's an Adam hat just for you, styled to bring out your best features. The soft-looking, genuine all-fur felt and the smart new colors also add distinction to the wearer of an Adam. And remember, that fine array of hats you see in the Adam store window is on the shelves, too. You're sure to find the hat that's right for you in an Adam store. Now, here's Dr. Weird.
Now I'll finish my story, stand in for death. The hearse has left the city behind and is nearing Woodcrest Cemetery. Mile after mile, Paul is driven in silence as O'Hara questions his father about Tony Williams.
Well, here we are, O'Hara, the entrance to the cemetery.
So we are. Go ahead, Paul, drive in.
Well, O'Hara, if you go into the cemetery with us, how will you get back to town?
That's all right. I don't mind walking from the grave back to the main road. Go ahead, Paul. Drive in.
But O'Hara, you...
Go ahead, Paul. What are you waiting for? Well, I'm certainly glad, Charlie, that you and Paul aren't mixed up in Tony's escape. You know, if you were, it'd mean 10 years apiece for you in the penitentiary.
You know we wouldn't help a killer like Tony Williams.
Sure, I know that. Guys like Tony have a way of intimidating people.
Oh, but not me, O'Hara.
Yes, Charlie, even you. Tony's smart, and he has an even smarter lawyer. Remember when he was on trial for the murder of that state trooper? He beat that rap because witnesses refused to testify. Tony had intimidated him, and he was acquitted even though everyone knew he was guilty.
Yes, but this time he wouldn't have a chance of escaping the chair.
I'm not so sure, Charlie. And even if he were convicted, let me tell you, the chair would be far too good for him. Don't you agree?
Oh, yes, you're right, O'Hara.
Well, here we are.
Oh, is that the grave you're going to bury old Luigi in?
Yes.
There doesn't seem to be anybody around. Where are the men that lower the coffin into the grave and do the burying?
There aren't any. You see, Luigi died penniless. I'm burying him out of my own pocket. I couldn't afford the men to do it.
You mean that you and Paul are going to bury him by yourselves?
That's right, O'Hara.
Well, I'll give you a hand.
But that isn't necessary. My father and I can manage alone.
Yes, the coffin is only a little cheap pine one, and old Luigi weighs very little. It's nothing at all to manage.
Oh, nonsense. If you two are paying for old Luigi's funeral out of your own pocket, the least I can do is give you a hand. Come on.
But, O'Hara, it'll take at least an hour to bury him, and there's no sense in your wasting all that time.
Yes, besides, it's getting dark fast, don't you think?
I'll help you bury old Luigi. And then we can all go back to the city together.
But, O'Hara, your clothes.
Just an old suit. A little dirt won't hurt it. Come on, let's get the coffin out and get started. Now, let's ease it out of the hearse, down to the ground. That's it. Say, you two forgot to lock the coffin. Yeah, that's better.
O'Hara.
Did you want to say something, Charlie?
Paul were mixed up in Tony's escape, it would mean 10 years in the penitentiary.
No. No, Harold, I didn't want to say anything.
Okay. Paul, have you got the ropes you used to lower the coffin into the grave?
Yes, sir. Here they are.
All right. Let's get it over with. All right. Let the coffin down easily. That's it. Old Luigi isn't as light as you might think. Where are the shovels, Paul?
Here.
Fine. You use one while I use the other.
What?
Charlie, you'd better take it easy. Well, Paul and I shovel the dirt in.
No. No, don't do it. Let me out of this coffin. Let me out.
Oh, what's the matter, Charlie? You're as pale as a ghost. You look as though you're hearing voices.
Well, O'Hara, don't. Don't you hear?
I don't hear a thing.
O'Hara, listen to me. I surrender, O'Hara. I'll confess everything. The state trooper I murdered. Killing your brother, the little kid I ran over. Let me out, O'Hara. Let me out.
O'Hara, you heard what he said. He confessed everything.
I didn't hear a thing. And neither did you two. Do you understand?
Yes, we understand, O'Hara.
Do you, Charlie?
Yes, I understand.
Okay, Paul. And let's start shoveling the dirt in.
No, O'Hara. Don't. Don't bury me alive. I'll confess everything, O'Hara. Don't bury me alive.
poor Tony, wasn't it? It must be unpleasant to be buried alive. You know, I've often wondered how long it takes a person to suffocate in a coffin. Now, if some brave soul were to volunteer for an experiment, I could... Oh, you have to go now. Too bad. But perhaps you'll drop in on me again soon. I'm always home. Just look for the house on the other side of the cemetery. The house of Dr. Weir.
Coming up, Beyond Midnight, which was a South African show that ran between January 11th, 1968, and March 24th, 1970. I wasn't able to find an exact date for the night that this show originally ran, so we'll just have to be satisfied with the fact that it was sometime in 1970. In case you're curious, the name of the show is Let Me See Your Face.
There are certain people, often well enough liked, genial souls whom one is always glad to meet, yet who have the faculty of disappearing without being missed. Crutchley was one of them. It wasn't until his name was mentioned casually that evening at the Stourgates that most of us remembered we hadn't seen him for the last year or two.
Yes, I remember. I was talking to old Crutchley at the time.
Oh, he's awfully sweet. I always liked him. Wasn't it queer? He seemed to have dropped completely out of things.
For the last year or two, he's been living very quietly with his people in Norfolk.
Oh, really?
I heard from him only the other day, as a matter of fact.
I wonder why he's chosen to efface himself. He was rather a lamb in his way. Oh, I used to adore that shiny black hair of his, which always made me think of patent leather.
It's as white as the ceiling now.
Pardon?
I said, it's as white as the ceiling now.
Oh, no. We're speaking of Simon Crutchley.
Simon Crutchley. I mean Simon Crutchley.
But that lovely, sleek hair. What happened? Did he have a nervous breakdown?
Something like that.
Biotex, the new soak and pre-wash powder, presents Beyond Midnight by Michael McCabe.
In this series of programs, ladies, it's our intention to talk to you about Biotex and promote it to you for the laundry. Now, we've made claims that Biotex will get rid of the stubbornest stains just by soaking. I dare say, like others, you feel a bit skeptical about these claims. And so we've been collecting letters from ladies who use Biotex just to quote to you from time to time in order to authenticate our advertisement. And Mrs. O'Duff of Beach Road, Sea Point in the Cape, wrote and said that Biotex is a very welcome product for the household. Biotex has a unique quality that it does what it claims to do. Mrs. Duff finished by saying, I have proved your claims about Biotex and am delighted with the results. And then a Mrs. Rita Stewart of Hunt Stratum Avenue, Littleton, Transvaal said, we have tried your Biotex for all our children's clothes and also white underclothing, and were absolutely amazed at the change in their appearance. And I can assure you, said Mrs. Stewart, that I will be a regular user of Biotex. So buy Biotex for yourself and your laundry.
Darn cold, isn't it?
Good of you, Handy, to share your cab like this.
Our ways lie in the same direction. There was a method in my madness, though, Price, old man. I wanted to ask you about Crutchley.
Oh.
I smell a story.
Yes. It's a queer and rather terrible story. There's even one bit that he couldn't... or wouldn't tell. So no one but he knows what the sight was that sent him off his head for 6 months and turned his hair as white as snow. The night's young yet. Come to my place to have a drink. I'll tell you all I know.
A driver.
Anyway, he was greatly interested in Joan of Arc, you see, and decided to go over to France to work, as it were, on the spot. I don't know if you like Rouen. Crutchley was delighted with it. He found a hotel practically undiscovered by the English and the Americans. L'Hôtel d'Avignon. It stands halfway down one of those old-world streets near the Gare de la Rouge en Duc. Crutchley liked it immediately and decided to stay. It was out of season. There were plenty of rooms. It was a hotel where many ate, but few slept. Crutchley then had a choice of rooms on the first floor.
Monsieur?
Well, this seems... There's a little garden out here.
Oui, monsieur. The hotel is very old. It is built onto the side of the hill. The garden...
And the garden's a story about the street. Oh, I care for this. There won't be much sun, will it, though? Well, that's a plane tree, isn't it?
Monsieur?
Yes, I think it is. Quiet. Reminds me of some of the little squares in the Inns of Court.
Oui, monsieur.
Yes, please. I should like this room. Please arrange my luggage to be sent up. I'm a writer, you see, and the garden appeals to me as a place to work.
It never occurred to our friend that a square enclosed on all sides by brick and almost completely starved of sunlight would be something of an unhealthy place. He was quite fascinated. The very next day, he took pen and writing materials, and sitting on one of the decrepit paint-peeling seats, he started on his study of the Maid of Orléans. To begin with, his writing wasn't successful. I think Crutchley mistook the almost unnatural silence for peace. Instead, the lack of noise bred in him an indefinable restlessness. It was almost a relief to break off from his labors and go out into the little town. Crutchley had 5 days at the hotel, 5 fruitless days as far as work went, when something strange happened. It was his habit to undress in the dark because his window was overlooked by dozens of others. One night, he was smoking and stepping into his pajama trousers when he wandered over the window and looked out.
Plane tree might be carved out of jade. Nothing stirring at all.
He looked down to the old green seat where he'd tried to work only that morning. With a faint, unreasonable thrill and a slight tingling of the nostrils, he realized that someone was sitting there.
It's a woman.
Yes, a woman. She sat with her head turned away. One arm was thrown along the sloping back of the seat. He said that her attitude was one of extreme dejection, of abject and complete despair.
Well, this time of night? Can't see. I could never see her face. Not even from one of the windows on the western side. The scarf she's wearing hides completely... Didn't expect her to sit there all night, did you, Crutchley?
Come in.
Good morning, monsieur.
Good morning.
Have you sleep well, monsieur?
Oh, I got some. Well, I tell you what, I've been meaning to ask you for the last week. Can I have a harder pillow?
Monsieur?
Pillow. Harder. I'm sorry, my French is about as good as my Lithuanian, and I don't speak that at all. A pillow. This thing here. Harder.
Ah, oui, oui.
Yes, thanks. Oh, one more thing. Who's the lady who sits out there in the garden late at night? I mean, I say sits. Well, she was there last night anyway. Somehow, though, I did have the feeling that she might go there often. Hmm? Who is she? A sort of sad-looking woman.
The chambermaid turned towards the window. Our friend saw a rapid movement of her right hand. It was done very quickly. Just the touch of her forefinger on her brow and a rapid fumbling of fingers at her breast. But he knew she had made the sign of the cross.
There is no lady staying in the house, monsieur. Monsieur has been mistaken. Will monsieur take coffee or the English tea?
Darling, let's go out and paint the town red.
But what about your headache?
Oh, that's gone. Grandpa headache powders did the trick.
Grandpa headache powders kill pain, soothe strained nerves, and lift depression. Grandpa headache powders are extra effective because they have a triple action. Grandpa headache powders work extra fast because they dissolve almost immediately. Get fast, effective relief from any pain, all pain. Get Grandpa headache powders.
Ah, Grandpa.
Soak, soak, that's all you have to do. Soak, soak, just for an hour or two, you'll find things look as good as new when you use new Biotechs.
Amazing new Biotechs acts with a biological action to soak out the stubbornest stains and loosen dirt. New Biotechs is great for all textiles and synthetics, whites and colors. It contains no bleach. Get amazing new Biotechs today and let soaking do the washing.
The wine list, monsieur.
Oh, thank you, Pierre. Thanks.
Are you quite comfortable in your room, sir?
Mm-hmm. Oh, quite, thank you.
There is a very pleasant room in the front, sir. It's quite so big, and then there is the sun. Perhaps you like it better, sir, huh?
Mm-hmm. The white wine there, please. How do you pronounce it, Pierre?
Le Cromertin, monsieur. Oh, a good choice, very good. The room, sir, in the front.
No, thanks. I shouldn't get a wink of sleep. You see, none of your motor traffic seems to be equipped with silencers. With trams, motor horns, and market cars bumping about all over the place across those cobbles, I should never get any peace.
Very good, monsieur.
I believe I'm on the trail of something queer here. The chambermaid's been talking to him, obviously. I wonder what's wrong. What they think is wrong.
Crutchley forgot about it for a little while and tucked into the very excellent food they served at L'Hôtel d'Avignon. When the head waiter returned to his table, though, with the wine, he reopened the subject.
Why do you want me to change my room?
I do not wish for you to change your room if you are satisfied, monsieur.
Well, when I am not satisfied, I say so. Why do you think I may not be?
I only wish for you to be more comfortable, sir. There is no sun behind the house. It is better to be where the sun comes sometimes. Besides, I think monsieur is one who sees.
The head waiter's last remark seemed cryptic, but our friend let it go. He didn't feel like discussing the sad lady he'd seen at any length with Pierre. During the afternoon and evening, Crutchley had tried to work. He was incapable of concentration, though. He knew, and he was angry with himself because he knew, that he was eking out his patience until night came, in the hope of seeing once more that still figure of despair in the garden.
Thank you.
sitting in the same place. He was unable to explain, even to himself, why he knew. It was midnight. She was there, as before, and Crutchley felt his eagerness mingled with an indescribable fear. He seemed to hear a cry of warning from the honest workaday world into which he had been born. He said it was like starting on a voyage, feeling no motion from the ship, and then being suddenly aware of a spreading space of water between the vessel and the quay.
Madam, look at me. Madam, let me see your face. Then I must come to you.
Monsieur. Where are you going, sir?
What the devil's got to do with you?
The devil, eh? Bien, monsieur. I think perhaps he has something to do with it. You will please have the goodness to return to your room. No, not the room which you have left, sir. That is not a good room. But come with me, I shall show you another.
What do you mean by interfering with me? It's not a prison or an asylum. I'm going to the garden for a breath of fresh air before I go to sleep.
That, sir, is impossible. The air of the garden is not good at night. Besides, the doors are locked, and the patron, he have the keys.
Then you're blasted insolent, that's what you are. Tomorrow I'll report you. Now get out of my way. Take me for a thief because I leave my room at midnight. Never mind. I can reach the garden from my window.
What do you think you're doing, man?
Shh. Monsieur. Monsieur. The bon Dieu has sent me to save you. I have waited tonight because I know you must try to enter the garden. Have I your permission to enter your room with you and speak with you a little while?
This is bedlam. Oh, if you must.
I do not think she is there, sir, because I am here and I do not see. Monsieur is the one who sees, as I tell him this morning. But he will not see her when he is with one who does not see.
What are you talking about?
Who is she? Who she is, I cannot say, sir.
And the head waiter blessed himself with quick, nervous fingers.
But who she was, I can perhaps tell you.
You mean to try and tell me she's what they call a ghost, apparition, or some blasted thing?
It does not matter what one calls her, monsieur. She is here sometimes for certain who are able to see her. Monsieur wishes very much to see her face. Monsieur must not see it. There was one who looked 5 years ago, and another perhaps 7, 8. The first he make die after 2, 3 days. The other, he is still mad. That is why I come to save you, monsieur. There was in this town a notary of the name Lebrun. And in a village halfway from here to Dieppe is a grand chateau in which there lived a lady, une jeune fille, with her father and mother. And the lady was very beautiful, but not very good, monsieur.
Well, go on. But I don't quite see what this has to do
monsieur,
with...
you will, please. Eh bien, Monsieur Lebrun fell in love with her. I think she loved him too, better as all the others. So he make application for her hand. But he was bourgeois and she was aristocrat. He had not so very much money, and the application, it was refused. And so they find for her another husband who she loved not, and she find herself someone else, and there is divorce. And she have many lovers, for she was very beautiful, but not so very good. For 10 years, perhaps, she make her beauty to make slaves of men. And one he made kill himself because of her. But she does not mind. And all the time, Monsieur Lebrun, he does not marry because he could not love another woman. But at last, this lady, she have a dreadful accident. It is a lamp which blow up and hurt her face. In those days, the surgeons did not know how to make new features. Oh, it was dreadful, monsieur. She had been so lovely, and now she have nothing left except just the eyes. And she go about wearing a long, thick veil because she had become terrible to see. And her lovers, they no longer love. And she have no husband because she have been divorced.
What happened? You mean she's the
so,
one?
Monsieur Lebrun, he write to her father, and once more he make offer for her hand. The father, he is willing because she no longer very young and she is terrible to see. But the father, he's a man of honor, monsieur, and he insist that Monsieur Lebrun see her face before he decide if he still wish her in marriage. So a meeting is arranged, and her father and her mother bring her here to this hotel. The lady come with them wearing her thick veil. She insists to see Monsieur Lebrun alone. So she wait out there in the garden. Love is not always what we think it. Well, perhaps Monsieur Lebrun think all the time that his love goes deeper than her beauty. And when he see her dreadful, changed face, he find out the truth. Perhaps when she put aside the veil, she see that he flinch. But Monsieur Lebrun, he walk out alone, and she stays sitting on the seat down there. And presently, her mother and her father come, but she does not speak or move. And in her hand, they find a little empty bottle, monsieur.
She...
All her life, she lived for love. Lebrun is the last of her lovers. When he no longer love, then that is the last of everything. She had bring the bottle with her in case he does not love. So, it happened a long time ago. And now perhaps, monsieur, understand why perhaps it is better he sleep in the front of the building tonight and change his hotel tomorrow.
But why does she come back?
How do we know, monsieur? She's a thing of evil. When her face was lovely, while she lived, she used it to destroy men. Now she still uses it to destroy, but otherwise. She has some great evil power which draw those who can see her. They feel they must not rest until they have looked upon her face. And that face is not good to look upon.
Ah.
Another drink handy, old man?
No, thanks. Listen, that can't be all. Poor old Crutchley. But that can't be all.
No, it isn't quite all. I wish that it were. Crutchley was scared. He changed his room, and the next day he moved out. He went to another hotel, tried to work, but couldn't. The horror of the thing had a fascination for him. And the next night, as it started to get dark, he asked himself why he shouldn't go and look. He was compelled.
Why shouldn't I go and see? It couldn't hurt me. Not if I look from a distance.
He didn't realize that she was drawing him to her. He went to the hotel, L'Hôtel d'Avignon. He walked around the building twice and then walked straight in through the swing doors as if he still stayed there. He went to the first floor and found one of the doors that led into the walled garden. It was late and the door was unlocked. He just stood there, staring in horror at that which sat upon the seat. He was drawn like a moth to a candle flame.
Madam, please look at me. Madam, let me see your face. Madam, please look at me. Madam, I know your story and I pity you. Allow me to see your face.
He was lost. He knew it. The power was too strong for him. He bent over her.
I mean...
That's the part Crutchley can't really describe. There weren't any features left in her face. But it wasn't just that. It was something much worse, much more subtle. Something happened, I know, before his sense left him. Poor devil, he couldn't tell me. He's getting better, though. Nerves still in shreds, of course. And... he has one or two peculiar aversions.
What are they?
He can't bear to be touched. Or to hear anybody laugh.
Now, ladies, we're speaking about biotechs in this series of programs, and Mrs. E.B. Granger of Gordon Road, Heathfield, in the Cape, wrote to say that she decided to try our biotechs just to see if it lived up to our claims. And she said, I bought a packet, and lo and behold, it actually did just what the advert said. I'm so proud of the children's white shirts, the hankies, and the underwear, that I want to say it will be biotechs for me every washing day from now on. Some of my family's accessories were left with slight stains, but now, thanks to biotech soaking, they come out white, and the stains do go away, as you say. Now, that is a statement from Mrs. Granger of Heathfield of the Cape, and it bears out what we have been saying to you ladies ever since biotechs first came on the market. We said to you, it is different to any washing product that you've ever used before. We claim that the stubbornest stains will vanish, and people like Mrs. Granger bear out our claims. Remember, biotechs.
Beyond Midnight is presented every Friday night at 9:30 by Biotechs, the new soak and pre-wash powder. The program is adapted for broadcasting and produced by Michael McCabe.
Up next is an episode, Grinville's Planet by name, from a South African series called SF-68, from 1968. SF-68 will bear a strong relationship to Beyond Midnight. This is because not only was it done in the same country, by the same crew of producers and writers. In fact, SF-68 was canceled in 1969 for Beyond Midnight. A sort of interesting thing is that although both shows were produced in South Africa, the locations are not in South Africa, but are generally transplanted to England. I'm not quite sure why that is, although I am aware that Michael McCabe, the producer and writer for this show, would later emigrate to London and do a considerable amount of work there for radio and television.
because he was back aft alone. He sat quietly relaxed. He wasn't bored. It was just that he had no interest. After 14 years in the mapping command, even the strangest of the new worlds was routine to him. What little imagination he had was beginning to center upon a small farm he'd seen on the southern plains of Vega 5. The brightness that Wisher didn't see grew with the passing moments. A pale young man named Grenville, who was Wisher's crewman, watched it for a long while, absently. When the gleam took on brilliance and a blue-white dazzling blaze, Grenville was startled. He stared at the screen for a long moment, then carefully checked the distance. Still a few light minutes away, the planet was already uncommonly bright. The blueness and the brightness flowed in together. It was the most beautiful thing Grenville had ever seen.
SF-68. Biotex, the new soak and pre-wash powder, brings you SF-68. Stories which plunge vividly into other worlds, other dimensions, other times. SF-68. Adapted for radio and produced by Michael McCabe. Grenville's Planet.
Green. Clouds. Look at the clouds. Sam, look. Isn't it beautiful? See?
Whew. Well, I'll be. It's blue. The entire world's blue. Ice caps. Clouds are white. But the rest's entirely blue. It's all water. A world of water. How's that for a freak, huh? One in a million, right? I bet you never saw anything like that.
Hang on, I'll make a check.
There's no land. A world of water. I suppose it was bound to happen sooner or later. But nobody else in Mapping Command. No one's found a world of water till now.
Circling. We'll move into the dark side of the planet in 12 seconds. Watch carefully.
Bound to happen, though, wasn't it? Considering Earth, which is a land area covering only 1/4, yes. And when you consider the odds, chances are that there are quite a number of planets with scarcely any land area at all.
Let's go down.
Down? Down where?
Down low. I want to see what's living in that ocean. region. Leveling off completed. 1,000 feet. Screen at full magnification.
And you're the man who always follows the regulations without question.
I do, normally. Without the rigs, nothing can run. Death trap. Nowhere in space is the need for rules as great as out here on the frontier. We owe our lives to the rigs.
Then I wonder how they'd feel about us probing the water of an all-water planet from 1,000 feet up.
Inevitably, there are some things the rigs can't foresee. All planets are new, but this one's newer than all the rest. Extra different. It's all water. Nothing. Nothing at all. No fish. No seaweed. 800 feet, that's as near as we're going.
Evolution's been confined underwater, then? Completely underwater?
If there is evolution. If...
Look! Sam, see? An island.
Yes, I see it.
They didn't see the second island. Radar picked it up for them. They patrolled the dark side of the planet, but found no more islands.
This planet's my assignment. They might even name it after me. There are a load of planets named after men in Mapping Command. When the tourists come, they'll be coming to Grenville Planet, one of the most spectacular wonders of the universe.
We'll land.
Revealed the presence of a great number of small, four-footed animals. But only one type was larger than the dog, and that one was slow and noisy. Both men were standing close in by the ship. It was a rule. You never left the ship area until you were sure. The regulations said so.
Have to be careful about snakes. How's the etching? And, reading the meter. It's good. Okay, let's breathe this world.
It's good. It is good. Queer sand. Red. Red and warm.
You can't call the vegetation jungle. Everything's too stiff. Unreal, sort of. Nothing over 10 feet. Everything's sort of...
regular. Yeah. I noticed.
And so they explored. Wisher began to feel more confident. They had their rifles. They had the ship and the alarm system. There was nothing that could harm them. The day passed. Just before twilight, two of the moons came out.
Moons.
What?
I was just thinking.
What about the moons?
I wasn't thinking about them exactly. I was thinking about the tide. Four good-sized moons in conjunction could raise one heck of a tide.
So?
That's probably where the land went.
I'll let the technicians worry about all that.
No, it's just that these islands have no right to be here at all. Four moons... they could produce tides that would wash continents away. Or maybe the tides are far apart, centuries apart. Huh? Evolution. 1 billion years underneath the sea, with no land to take the first developing mammals. I wonder what's going on this minute underneath all that water.
they went into the ship for the night, Wisher didn't need the regulations to tell him to seal the airlock and set the alarm screens. Ones. A weird, bristling thing with a lean, powerful body. By the time morning came, Wisher, who'd been frightened half to death, was in favor of leaving for the one remaining star they would map before returning to base. Grenville was secretly keen to return as well, but for different reasons. Grenville had decided that Grenville was now a famous man.
That island! Over there. That's North Grenville. This one, South Grenville.
Don't go near the water.
All right, Mummy. I'll work the edge of the vegetation. Funny. No birds.
Leave the rifle. Take the pistol. Use it.
Okay.
No shellfish. The beach is a bare, dead plot of ground. There's danger here. I know it, but I can't explain it. Sea, noiseless. No tide, no waves, nothing. It's because there's nothing, just stillness everywhere, that I know there's danger. The seas of every world I've ever been to have been choked with life. From Earth on out to Deneb. Anyway, I'll take a specimen of the water. It took a lot of courage for Wisher to approach those waves. He took a quick water sample and hurried back to the ship. The water was earth water, so far as his instruments could tell. There was nothing wrong with it. There was nothing much living in it either. Then Grenville came back with his specimen sack.
No shellfish.
Why?
Well, maybe they just don't like it here.
The computer's finished constructing the orbits of those moons.
So?
So, the moons conjunct every 112 years. They rise at a tide of 600 feet.
Well, I don't see what...
The tide is at least 400 feet higher than either of the islands.
Oh.
Where in the name of... Grenville? Where did the animals come from?
They should be drowned.
Right. And would be. Unless they're amphibian, they're not. Or unless a new batch evolves every 100 years.
It doesn't make sense.
The sand, it seems artificial. Why is the island here at all?
And then the idea popped unbidden into his brain. And he slowly turned and looked at Grenville, was staring moodily out to sea.
That's it. That has to be the reason. The whole island is artificial. It's restored. Put here by whatever... whoever lives under the sea. Leave yet. We haven't any proof. Besides, there hasn't been any manifestation of danger.
We've got enough proof for me.
It's easy to understand, isn't it? Evolution kept on going, changing, like it's done everywhere else in the universe. Only here, where the mammals began coming up onto the land, they had no room to expand.
Mm.
They were being washed away all the time. Every 100 years, the continents were worn down below sea level. But evolution never stopped. It continued underneath the sea. Eventually it came up with an intelligent race. Heaven knows what they are or how far they've progressed. They must be pretty highly evolved. They couldn't have done something like this.
There's no way of telling.
The Egyptians built the pyramids. Tougher job than this. You can't tell from the islands how far advanced they are. Zoo?
What?
Zoo. Things under the sea, perhaps.
Now, if they wanted a zoo, they'd built one under the sea, surely. Where they are, where they live, not up here. They'd have their zoo out underneath the water, where they could travel with ease, with animals in airtight compartments or something.
If there is anything living under the sea.
Gren, there's got to be. Otherwise, how do you explain this? The island, the other one, too.
I don't know. And another thing. If there is something, why hasn't it come here? Why haven't they come to see us? They must have noticed our ship.
They wouldn't be just like fish, would they? These things, they need hands, tentacles. Will you get the animal specimens?
Just plants and a small lizard thing.
Well, we'll have to get one of those things that set off the alarm last night. But to heck with the rest. We'll let HQ worry about that. I'll pack up, make ready. You go and get that thing.
What?
I said go and get that animal thing.
Then we leave, huh?
Yes.
Do you think we need one of those things that...
set the alarm off last night? Yes.
Okay. You wouldn't like to have a shot at getting one and let me pack up?
No.
Okay.
Okay, then.
I think I'll just smoke a cigarette before I leave. Won't have much time if I'm to get one of those things. Just 5 minutes and then I'll... You?
No, thanks.
Queer.
Huh?
The place. It's queer. It's the queerest world I've ever been on. You know, usually there's all sorts of things. You know, different, of course, because every world's different, but somehow identifiable. You know, you can relate the things you find, discover, with other things on Earth or Deneb or Helestra or... You know. But here... There's hardly any insects. You noticed that. And all that still sea out there. On Earth, any place on the whole planet, there'd be seabirds flying about, crawling, little crabs scuffing about the sand, seaweed, everything you can think of. But here, it's like a kid's toy. A model.
Grindle, of course, was talking for the sake of talking. He didn't want to go and hunt the animal. He wasn't afraid of the animal, of course. He'd hunt a larger and more dangerous specimen to take back to Earth for the scientists.
I mean, intuition. Sometimes, surely, intuition's enough. If a man feels there's danger, feels something somewhere not good, then it'd be stupid to wait till he gets his head knocked off to prove it. See what I mean?
No.
I was afraid you wouldn't.
Well, I see what you mean, of course, but... What'd you do?
A cigarette. I burnt my... Enjoyed that.
Okay, go and get one of those things. Okay, then we'll scoot.
Yes, okay. Right, see you.
And Grenville turned and struck off automatically down the beach. He never came back. At the end of the third hour, Wisher went to the arms locker and pulled out a heavy rifle. Then he went outside the ship again and waited.
If Grenville comes back before me, it'll be all right. Does the alarm set to deactivate when it registers the sound pattern of either of our voices? If he comes back and doesn't see me, he'll know the alarm's on. If no one comes back, the ship will blow by itself.
The beach was wide and curved. Grenville's deep footprints were easy to follow. From out of nowhere, it seemed, a wind sprung up. Wisher welcomed it like a friend. Something at last was happening on Grenville's planet.
This is the end of it. When I get out of this, I'll go home. With Grenville or without him.
The heel prints turned abruptly into an alien forest. Wisher walked some distance farther on to a relatively clear space. He turned, stepping carefully. He started to circle the spot where Grenville had gone in. The wood around him was soggy, sterile.
Something's at the ship. Ship can take care of itself. Me, another 5 minutes and then Grenville, my lad. I'm sorry, very sorry.
Racial fear, he knew. He reached for his rifle and felt the metal bite into his legs anew. But the rifle was beyond him. Out of his belt, he dragged his pistol, and in a sea of pain, held upright by the trap, he waited. Nothing came. Why? Why? This had happened to Grenville, too. Why?
Why?
Strangely, he was not afraid. He'd broken the regulations, and this had happened, and he'd expected it. He waited. But nothing came. Why?
Why?
He looked down into the hole, and he saw the hot redness of his own blood. And as he watched it bubble, he realized that he was dying.
Why doesn't something come? I can at least see what they are. To a shooting. If it comes to a shooting, why doesn't something come?
Why?
Why?
He had very little time. He realized this. But he was hopeful. He wanted so much for something to come. He needed so much to know. Why? Why? Before something came, unfortunately, he died. The traps had been dug in the night. From out of the sea, they had come to dig in the preserve. For a preserve was what the island was all that it could have been, and then returned to the sea to wait. The traps had been dug in the night. The ship had been seen from the very beginning, and its purpose understood. The best brains of the sea had gathered and planned. The enormous, manta-like people, whose name was unpronounceable, but whose technology was not far behind Earth's, met in consultation and immediately understood. It was necessary to capture the ship. Therefore, the Earthmen must be separated from it. And it was for this reason that Wisher had died. But now, to the astonishment of the things, the ship was still alive. It stood silent and alone in the whiteness of the beach, ticking and sparking within itself, and near it on the bloodied sand were the remains of the one who had come too close. The things waited, exultant. The conquest of space was in their hands. The day grew late and became afternoon. Within the ship, of course, there was ticking, and a small red hand moved towards zero. In a little while, the ship would blow, and with it would go the island and a great chunk of the sea. But the beings could not know. Second by second, with the utter mechanical loyalty of the machine, the small red hand crept forward. The sea near the beach was frothy and white. A crowd was forming.
The Hall of Fantasy was originally a local series out of Utah that found its way onto the airwaves sporadically from 1947 to 1952. The anthology was picked up for national syndication by Mutual and broadcast 1952 through mid-1953. This program is often overlooked even by rabid fans of old-time radio. And this is unfortunate, since it provides some very unique and dramatic material. The acting in this is really good. Yeah, I know. Most people will tell you not to modify the word unique with something like a very, very unique. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do it. Early on, the series was concentrated on murder mysteries. That earlier run between 47 and 48. But later shows were devoted to horror and some science fiction. Too bad that not all the episodes have survived, or at least have been found. Only about 40 of perhaps as many as 100 shows exist. Anyway, this episode is from February the 2nd of 1953, and it's called The Silver Flask.
And now, the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall descend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of Silver Flask.
And so it is that the prophecy of Charming shall be fulfilled. For the evil committed, your reward is death.
And from the mouth of the flask poured a crawling white fog, which became quite dense, and then assumed the size and shape of the demon of the night, and it reached its hands towards his throat.
Stay away from me. Stay away from me.
In just a moment, the Hall of Fantasy will present The Silver Flask. And now for our story. An original tale of fantasy by Richard Thorne, entitled The Silver Flask.
And so it was that you town caused the Silver Flask to be made. Small and thin it was, with a diamond embedded into its face, so that it could see. And we summoned the sorcerer Charming and bade him bestow upon this lamp the mantle of magic. And this was done. For goodness, it will return good. For evil, it will bring death.
It began commonly enough. Chris and Pat Redfield and I had dropped into an art dealer's shop in the avenue. I don't know what made us go in. I think it's mere circumstance. There was an auction going on.
Going once, going twice, three times and gone, sold to the lady in the brown fur coat.
Oh, that was a bargain, Chris, a real bargain.
I don't know, maybe. I wonder what'll be up next.
Probably an old bed warmer. Oh, we must as well leave. I don't think there's anything here we'd be interested in, Pat.
Oh, just a few more minutes, Chris.
But we'll be late for... Oh, all right, Pat, but just a few minutes.
Oh, now, there's a husband for you.
May I ask for your attention once more, ladies and gentlemen? Thank you. Now I ask you to look at the object in front of me. It's a flask, a silver flask. Perhaps tarnished a trifle, but silver nonetheless. How old this object is, no one has been able to ascertain. How it came into the possession of this company is a mystery. But the workmanship is definitely oriental. For a collector's item, it would be perfect.
I like the looks of
that. Now, who will bid for it, then?
I think I will.
A piece of art. Come, come, ladies and gentlemen. Who will be the first to make a bid on the silver flask?
Go ahead, Chris.
$10.
$10. The man in the blue overcoat bid $10. Do I hear 15? 15.
20.
$20 for the silver flask before me. $20 is the bid. Do I hear
25? 25.
30. 50. 50. No, Chris.
$50 is the bid. $50. Do I hear more? $50 is the bid. Going once. $50 going twice. $50 for the third time. Sold to Mr. Henry Stebbins.
Come on, let's get out of here.
All right, Chris.
You really wanted that flask, didn't you, Chris?
Yes, I don't know why, though.
Oh, it just caught your eye, that's all, darling.
Excuse me. Pardon me, please. Will you let me go through?
Now look, Chris, there's the man who outbid you.
Oh, he seems to be coming over here.
He's waving to us.
I wonder what he wants.
Please, madam, will you let me by? Thank you. Excuse me, sir, I couldn't help but notice you bidding against me. I'm terribly sorry that only one of us could own the silver flask.
Oh, it's perfectly all right.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Stebbins, Henry Stebbins. I'm retired now, you see, and my hobby is collecting unusual art objects. Your name is...
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Stebbins. This is Larry Reardon.
How do you do?
My wife, Pat Redfield.
How do you do?
And Chris is mine.
Really? I'm very pleased to meet you, all of you, you know. Are you by any chance interested in collecting art objects, Mr. Redfield?
I have an interest. I'm not a collector.
Mr. Reardon?
I'm afraid I'm in the same category as Chris.
I see. Well, I was wondering. I do have a rather good collection, you know, and I hope you won't think it presumptuous, but it's so infrequent that one meets people who are interested in the same things as he. Why don't you, all of you, come to dinner at my house next week? Say Monday?
Why, of course, Mr. Stebbins, we'd be delighted.
Here's my card. You will come, won't you? I'm sure you'll find it very interesting.
The following Monday, we went to Henry Stebbins' house. He seemed quite wealthy, for the house was large and lavishly furnished. After the meal, he showed us his collection, pausing finally when he came to the silver flask.
As you can see, the flask is a bit different, shall we say, from when you saw it last.
Why, it's as bright as a new coin.
That stone in the center, it wasn't there when I saw it at the auction.
Oh, yes, it was. It had been covered over by a thin layer of silver. I noticed the imperfection and took it off. Underneath was the diamond.
Are you serious?
Are you sure it's a diamond?
Oh, quite sure, Mr. Redfield. You see, the silver flask has quite a history. It's really very ancient.
How old is it?
Oh, at least 3,000 years, possibly more. It's a relic of the Yuan dynasty, lost for over two centuries.
How do you know these facts, Mr. Stebbins?
I've been watching for the flask for several years. Many times I was sure I'd found it, but needless to say, I was disappointed. At last, however, it's in my possession. Would you like to know some of its history?
Oh, yes, very much.
All right, then. It was first ordered made by the Chinese Emperor Yu Duan, made for him by the sorcerer Zhao Ming, who also was responsible for a certain jade dagger I would like to possess. Zhao Ming bestowed this magic upon it. For goodness, it would return good, and for evil, it would bring death. The flask was in the family of Yu Chuan for many generations. However, 100 years after it was first made, the last of the Chuans was emperor. A member of his court plotted against him. Strangely enough, the original motivation was possession of the silver flask. But the night he came to steal the flask...
Oh, there's Emperor's vegetable. Who is in here? What do you want? Where are you? It is so dark my eyes cannot see.
It is pity you not see dagger which brings you dead.
Back now to our story. An original tale of fantasy by Richard Thorne entitled The Silver Flask.
Our eyes were upon Stebbins as he talked. Yet we saw not the man before us, but the scene which his words conjured up in our minds. Is this story true, Mr. Stebbins?
Every word of it, Mr. Riddle.
Is that all to the story?
Oh, no, not at all. There's a good deal more to it. A good deal.
I'd like to hear the rest of the story.
Are you sure I'm not boring you?
No.
All right, then. Let me see. Where was I?
The emperor had just been murdered.
Oh, yes. What had originally started as a covetous fascination about the silver flask resulted in the murder of the last of the Juans. The killer knew of the supposed magical properties of the flask, yet he thought it only legend with no true significance. He took the silver flask with him when he left the side of the murdered emperor. No one knew of the emperor's death. When the killer retired for the night, he put the silver flask next to his bed. But he was unable to get sleep, and his gaze was drawn to the diamond in the flask, the all-seeing eye that Zhao Ming had given it. It began to glow and shine in the darkness, becoming a thing alive. The killer watched it in horrible fascination. And then he heard a voice.
And so it is that the prophecy of Zhao Ming shall be fulfilled. For the evil committed, your reward is death.
And from the mouth of the flask poured a crawling white fog which became dense, and then assumed the size and shape of a demon of the night, and it reached its hands toward his throat.
Stay away from me! Stay away from me!
So perished the killer of the last of the Juans.
It's a rather fantastic story.
Fantastic? Perhaps. The pattern has been repeated many times since, and perhaps it will be again.
There is something quite fascinating about it.
Yes, Mr. Redfield. Quite fascinating.
Of course, all that happened many years ago. I don't believe it's actually true. It's probably like so many other legends that change during the passage of the centuries. Endows a person or object with supernatural power. Even though what actually occurred originally was nothing out of the ordinary.
Well, that's quite possible, Mr. Reardon. But as a collector of these objects and their histories, I much rather prefer to believe the legend, as you call it.
Chris?
What?
Oh, you're so quiet. What were you thinking about?
It's really quite fascinating. The flask. I can hardly take my eyes off it.
The evening ended shortly thereafter with another invitation from Henry Stebbins that would return soon. Chris was silent as we drove home, his mind lost in thought, only occasionally joining in the conversation. I knew that he was thinking about the silver flask. I was inclined to think of the story Henry Stebbins had told us as coming from a man who was highly nervous, a man who, because of his loneliness and preoccupation with himself, would read into the slightest glance a willingness to commit murder. Three days later, Pat Redfield dropped into my office.
I hope you don't mind my coming in to see you like this, Larry.
Oh, of course not, Pat. It's a pleasure. Cigarette?
No, thanks.
Now, what seems to be the trouble?
Oh, how did you...
What a look on your face. What's bothering you?
It's Chris.
Chris?
That's right, Larry. I know it's a strange term to use, but... For the last 3 days, he seems like a man possessed. Even at night, when he's asleep, he has a nightmare. He talks and screams out.
When did this start?
That night we'd seen Henry Stebbins. I can't understand most of his words, but every once in a while I hear him say something about the silver flask. He seems to be struggling with someone or something. I just don't know. I'm so worried. I can't even think.
Oh, it's a story that Stebbins told us.
I know, but there must be some truth to it, Larry. Look at the tremendous fascination the silver flask holds for Chris. Sometimes I even think he'd be willing to kill Stebbins just to get his hands on it.
In the evenings, I took to parking my car across the street from Stebbins' house to see who his callers might be. About a week after Pat had been to my office, I'd been parked across from his house for several hours. It was almost midnight, and I was on the point of starting my car and driving home, when on my side of the street, about half a block away, I saw a familiar figure walking towards me. He walked slowly, like a man in a trance. His head turned so that his eyes were on Stebbins' house. Chris? What are you doing out here, Chris?
I might ask you the same question.
They're waiting for you.
Why me? Why not someone else?
Because no one else has an interest in the Silver Flask.
Has Pat been talking to you?
Not recently.
Then you know all about it, don't you, Larry? That I want the Silver Flask, that I'm going to get it now, tonight.
No, you're not, Chris.
Yes, I am, Larry. Now, get out of my way.
Put that knife back in your pocket, you fool.
It's pretty, isn't it? Just press a button and the blade snaps open. Out of my way.
You're not going anywhere with that knife.
No, we'll see about that.
Oh,
you asked for it, Larry. Oh, let go of my arm.
Drop the knife. Drop it. Drop it.
All right.
That's better. Take this little thing. Now get into the car.
Oh, I'll get into the car, all right, Larry. I won't make any fuss about that. You think you're doing me a favor by stopping me. I don't. Maybe my chance is lost tonight, but I'll get another. Don't worry about that. There isn't anything that's going to stand in my way. Not you, not Pat, most certainly not Stebbins. I'd even commit murder to get that Silver Flask.
Back now to our story. An original tale of fantasy by Richard Thorne entitled The Silver Flask.
Chris was quiet and sullen as I drove him home. He didn't say a word to me all the while we were together. I watched him enter the front door of his house and I drove back to my apartment. When I got there, I called Henry Stebbins.
Hello?
Mr. Stebbins, this is Larry Reardon.
Oh, yes.
You'd better make sure that your house is locked up tight from now on.
Your friend?
Yes. I've been watching the front of your house for several nights. Tonight, about midnight, I saw Chris. I think he intended to break in.
I'll be careful. Thanks for calling.
In the morning, for some reason, Henry Stebbins phoned first the Redfields and then me, and asked us to come to dinner that night. I couldn't understand his line of reasoning unless he enjoyed playing a cat-and-mouse game with Chris. Pat didn't want to go, but Chris insisted, and promptly at 7, we were at Stebbins' house. We finished the meal and adjourned to the library.
I'd like to see your collection again, Mr. Stebbins.
Oh, I'll be glad to show it to you. Would you two like to come with us?
No, I'll stay here if you don't mind.
So will I.
All right. Then just you and I'll go to see it, Chris.
Suits me.
We'll be back in a little while.
I wonder if we should have let him go alone.
Chris won't try anything while we're here, Pat.
Hope you're right.
Besides, I'm sure that Stebbins can protect himself.
Oh, I'm worried about him, Larry. Chris has changed, though. When we're alone, he never says anything anymore. He just doodles on a scratch pad with a pencil. Always draws the same picture.
The Silver Flask?
Yes. He thinks something's wrong with his mind.
Oh, I don't think
what
it's any...
What's he doing with it? Just a minute, Mr. Redfield. Where is it? Where's the Silver Flask?
Come on, Pat. We shouldn't have let him go alone.
I think it would be best to put the flask away. I know it disturbs you quite strongly.
I could kill you,
oh,
Stebbins.
We can't stop them, Larry.
Don't worry.
Now, stay away from me, Redfield.
You'd be better off dead.
All right, now. Stop it.
Stop it, both of you. He knew I wanted to see the flask. He hid it on purpose.
Thought it would be the wisest thing to do.
Oh, Chris, how could you do such a thing?
Let's just forget this ever happened.
I'm perfectly willing to do that, you know. I really don't mean to gloat, Mr. Redfield, but I have the Silver Flask and you haven't, and I know you wanted it.
Why, you...
Chris, you see, that's why I hid it from you. After all, as long as you don't know where it is, my life is safe. Isn't that right?
Stebbins was right, of course. As long as Chris didn't know the whereabouts of the Silver Flask, Stebbins' life would be safe. But if Chris knew where it was with his overpowering obsession to own it and Stebbins stood in the way, his life would mean nothing to Chris. But Chris had told me that he wouldn't stop, even at murder.
And so it was that you drawn caused the silver flask to be made. And we summoned the father, Chao Ming, and bade him restore upon the flask the mantle of magic. And this was done.
Two days later, I was home in the apartment. I sat down with a good book, and it was about 11 o'clock when the phone rang. Yes?
Oh, Larry, this is Pat. You'd better go over to the Stebbins' house right away.
Why?
Chris came home this evening, sat, fidgeted it all night long, and then about 15 minutes ago, he muttered something about the silver flask and ran out of the house.
You think he was going to see Stebbins?
Yes, I think so. You have to hurry over there, Larry, before he does anything.
Have you called Stebbins?
Yes, I warned him. But Chris might do anything. Go over there, Larry. See, there's nothing wrong. I have the strangest feeling that Stebbins is going to die tonight.
At last the time had come. I knew it would, sooner or later. Chris had to be stopped from entering that house at all costs. I hopped into my car and drove over to Stebbins' place as quickly as I could. Within 15 minutes, I was knocking on his front door.
Oh, I'm glad you came, Larry.
Pat phoned you, didn't she?
Yes, I'm sorry I took so long coming through the door, but I was looking out the front window to see who it was. Come in. It's strange what power the silver flask has, Larry.
You should never have invited him back here after I told you what had happened.
Oh, we might as well go into the library.
You know, I think you'd better call the police.
You think it's that serious?
Yes.
I'll call from the library.
Is your house secure?
Oh, yes. Everything's locked and bolted. Hey, sit down, won't you? I'll phone the police.
Stebbins. Flask still hidden?
What? Oh, no. It's over there on the table. Perhaps the police can send a man out and you'll be able to go home. Oh, hello? My name is Henry Stebbins. I have good reason to believe that someone is going to make an attempt on my life tonight. What? Name? Chris Redfield. He's wanted something of mine for some time. He'll do anything to get it. Yes, I'd appreciate that. Thank you very much. I'll have a man out here in 15 minutes.
I didn't tell you that Chris had a knife the night he came here to kill you, did I?
No, you didn't.
Well, that's funny. Still have it with me.
Well, we'll give it to the police when they get here.
Yes, I'm sure they'll find it.
What?
The knife. I'm sure the police will find it.
What do you mean?
This. It's Chris's knife. You should never have been afraid of him, Mr. Stebbins. Chris would never really kill you. But I would.
Stay away from me.
I can't do that. You see, Stebbins, everything fits in perfectly now. You've warned the police against Chris. They'll find his knife. They'll never suspect me.
You're insane.
No, far from it. I merely want the silver flask.
The curse. Don't forget the curse.
Who believes in curses, Mr. Stebbins?
Don't come any closer.
Just close enough. Ah! Good night, Mr. Stebbins. So, I have the silver flask. It stands in the dresser next to my bed. The diamond shines so in the dark. It seems almost to be getting brighter. I imagine the police are looking for Chris Wright. The diamond is getting brighter. And there's something else. The sound. Like the sound of escaping air. There's something here in this room with me.
Caused the silver flask to be made. Small and thin it was, with a diamond embedded into its face, so that it could see. And he summoned the sorcerer Chao Ming and bade him bestow upon the flask the mantle of magic. And this was done. For goodness, it will return good. For evil, it
So runs tonight's tale of the unusual, the terrifying, the unknown. Join us again when next we journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to hear another strange tale of the supernatural. All characters and events portrayed in these programs are fictional, and any similarity to actual events or persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental.
Well, okay, that's it for this show. I hope you enjoyed it. This is Gary Clinton, and I'm signing off. This is Billy Mays and his orchestra playing the incomparable Ira Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Good day, good night, whatever.